Now, my great pleasure to introduce our 10-minute speaker, Doug Ott.
My name is Doug, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Doug.
You know, that's pretty good. I couldn't say that when I first walked into this room. And, you know, this was the very first room, or right next door, I should say. This is an honest program. Next door was the very first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting that I ever went to. It was a firefighters group on a Tuesday morning. And that Tuesday morning, I had walked from Powell and Broadway up Powell Street over top of California, down Powell to Post, up Post to Van Ness, and somehow managed to get to the corner of Ellis and Gough Street. And there I stood, shaking and shimmering, just like it says in the big book. I was oozing something from just about every orifice of my body. Had thrown up twice on the way, probably the lousy orange juice that I had drunk. And somehow I got into this room. But I got here. But I wanted to stand up. I've just got 10 minutes, so I could kind of capsulize my drinking in one little poem. It was the middle of October, and I was feeling far from sober. I was burdened with an air of manly pride. When my knees began to shudder, so I lay me in the gutter, and a pig came up and laid by my side. We were speaking of fair weather, when good fellows get together, when a woman passing by was heard to say, "You can tell the man that boozes by the company he chooses." And the pig got up and slowly walked away. Yeah, there weren't too many people that wanted to be around me at the end of my drinking, I'll tell you. I had performed pretty well, for a matter of fact, from the early part of 1943 till 1986. So for about 43 years of drinking or not drinking to one degree or another, I was looking for something because I couldn't stand being Doug Robbins. And I tried every method there was to be somebody that I wasn't. And it finally stopped working. I could no longer go on. And when I got here on the corner of Ellis and Gough Street, and I walked into that first AA meeting, I remember the speaker. I don't know what he said, but I do know this. I knew that I had come to belong. And you know, and I still had that intolerant, belligerent denial. Because I think I heard the word God. Oh, I've been a foxhole Christian. You know, that old guy, I was, "Jesus, if you just get me out of it this time, I'll never do that again." And of course, that had gone on most of my life. But this particular day, I still had that belligerent denial. And I recall I said to some guy, I says, "God, I don't want to hear any of that God stuff. I don't believe in God." But you know the precious part about that whole thing? Was that there happened to be an old-timer, and he came up to me and he says, "Hey, Doug, you know something?" He says, "We don't believe in that God you don't believe in either." Jesus, that's pretty heavy stuff. But you know what? That was the door that opened for me. Because on page 46 of the big book, I read that chapter to the agnostic, and it says, you know, I don't have to choose anybody else's conception of a power greater than myself. The only thing I have to do is to believe in a power greater than myself as long as I don't think it's me. And you know, that's what I've been trying to do for a lot of years. And as soon as I found out that if I was even just willing to believe in a power greater than myself, all sorts of great things would start happening. And that's what happened in my life. I found a God as I don't understand him. Because from that, on page 47 of that big book in that chapter through the agnostic, it told me to, If I could just be willing to believe in a power greater than myself, I had laid the cornerstone. But also on the bottom of that page is an asterisk. It says, turn to spiritual awakening. And on that spiritual awakening, it said three little words, H-O-W, honesty, open-minded, and willing. I have never been honest in my life. I have been so prejudiced and intolerant all of my life that I couldn't let even anything get in my life because I was so self-centered. But the day that I got honest, just a little bit open-hearted and willing, things began to happen. And my life turned around because I found the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. Today, I could go and tell you that you could see the miracle that's sitting in every one of these seats. And why I was asked by Ben to speak here as a 10-minute speaker, I'll never know. But it certainly was it's meant to be, because I just can't think of anybody else that could remember that day standing out there at the corner and then walking in here. I have something in my pocket, and I hope it doesn't offend anybody. And if it does, well, that's too bad. Because this is the way I feel. I have no idea where I'm going. I do not see the road ahead of me. I cannot know for certain where it will end, nor do I really know myself. And the fact that I think I am following your will does not mean that I am actually doing so. But I believe this. I believe that the desire to please you does, in fact, please you. I hope I have that desire in everything I do. I hope I never do anything apart from that desire. And I know that if I do this, you will lead me by the right road, though I may know nothing about it at the time. Therefore, I will trust you always, for though I may seem to be lost and in the shadow of death, I will not be afraid, because I know you will never leave me to face my troubles all alone. Thank you, and God bless everyone.
Thank you, Doug. Thanks very much. And now I would like to introduce our main speaker for this evening, Keith D. Hello, everybody. I'm an alcoholic. My name's Keith. And the most important thing I can share with you, that it has not been necessary for me to take a drink or do any drugs since May the 11th, 1976, and for that I'm especially grateful. It's good to be sober, and it's good to be here. I want to thank Ben for inviting me, and I want to thank my friends who, the San Jose contingent, and the people who I've met in Alcoholics Anonymous, other people in the room that I've met at other functions like this, for coming here and supporting my sobriety. It's always a privilege to participate in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a privilege to do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous that is conducive to my sobriety. I think it's a special good feeling to be able to be with people who make you feel welcome. I think that's one of the most significant factors of sobriety, is to feel welcome. And the new people who are here, if you're new and sitting in this room, or if you've been here for a while and you feel troubled, I hope you feel safe. I hope my prayers are that you feel safe sitting in this room, because we certainly know what the feelings of the terror and the bewilderment are. And one of the most important things that I've come to understand about my sobriety is that when I'm in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm exactly where I'm supposed to be, doing exactly what I'm supposed to be doing. That's probably, for me, the greatest asset of the first step, is allowing me to feel comfortable within myself when I'm with you. And the most important thing I've come to understand when I come to Alcoholics Anonymous and admit that I'm an alcoholic is a simple fact that there are people in this room who understand how I drank. And there's people in this room who do not understand how I drank. But most of all, there's people in this room that understand what I got to do to stay sober. It's equally important in the identity of Alcoholics Anonymous is one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic about the feelings that we went through prior to getting here, what happened, and what it is necessary for us to do after we come here and stay. But it's equally important to touch on something in that identity when the doors open for a few
seconds there, the door of the sick mind seems to open from the inside. There's a little bit of hope, and that ray of hope comes from me, from the fact that I know that there's other people who have to do the things that I have to do to stay sober. Therefore, sobriety is not some gloomy doom, you know, this is it forever, sit in the basement of some church and say, why in the hell are we upstairs? You know? I have to know that this is what I need to do in order to stay sober. I also believe that, you know, the things that I'm willing to do in order to stay sober is directly proportional to the things that I had to do in order to get here. And the pain that I had to go through in order to get here is my pain. I have come to understand my threshold of pain. I got a very small pain tolerance, and I think that even gets smaller the longer you stay sober. And yet I had to go through the things that I had to go through in order to come here and do the things that I got to do in order to stay here. And there's also people in rooms, in this room and rooms like this, who identify with that. And therefore, to me, that ensures the fact that I'm really not different. I'm really not different. And I've been taught, since I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, to share with you a little bit of what it used to be like, what happened, what it's like today, in a general way. Thank God it's in a general way. And I'm grateful for that. And I've come to understand that. And, you know, in a sense, I could share what it used to be like and how little I've changed in the sense of that, too. If there's anybody here looking for a fast growth pattern, well, I guarantee you got the wrong cat. It's been a long ways, and it's been a long journey. Matter of fact, my sobriety is worse than most people's drunk logs, to tell you the truth. I don't tell you that to scare you away. For those of you who are really sick, that should give you a little hope. But I'm not one of those who came to Alcoholics Anonymous, put the plug in the jug, and have had a skip down the happy road of destiny ever since. I've come here, I've been taught to respect Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've tried my very best to do that, to respect the very thing that saved my life. But I didn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous with void of all the emotions and the feelings that an alcoholic is supposed to have from the very beginning, I suppose, maybe even at birth, on through the rest of my life. I was a scared little boy, and I grew up to be a scared little boy. And fear has been my partner. It's a constant companion. And I'm very active in Alcoholics Anonymous. I identify with the people who are sitting here a while ago that have all the feelings and the emotions for the first time. The same thing I identify with the people who are new, the people who stand up here. And we don't ask you to stand up so that we can embarrass you, however it does. And that's intended, in case it's intended. The amazing thing about Alcoholics Anonymous that I've come to understand, for the first 30 days that you're here, you're very significant. And after you get 31 days, you're no longer significant. You're really insignificant. They don't ask you to stand up to anything. As a matter of fact, if you get a rotten sponsor, they yell and scream at you a lot. You know? And that's Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous is a place where people go and we laugh at the things that other people cry at, and we cry at the things that other people laugh at. And it's all backward, and that's good. If you don't understand it, well, you got a chance. If we confuse you here, that's good, because that's the idea. It's absolutely necessary to confuse the sick mind so that maybe it gets so confused, or maybe a little humor in there that opens the door from the inside and we can stick the answer in real quick before it slams. If you're new or relatively new and you come to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and you wonder why they have speakers at places like this, particularly ones from out of town, as they get you in as soon as they can, they get right over to the meeting, don't even give you time to go to the bathroom, and they get you out of town before you have an opportunity to find out my character defects. Then you thank the program chairman for getting good speakers. You listen to the same crap the people you go to meetings with all the time. You know all their character defects, and they try to bring speakers in from outside so that you don't know them. If you're sponsoring people or relatively new in the game of sponsorship, the reason they have speakers also is so that you can bring somebody that you sponsor to meetings where there's a speaker, and then you can spend the next week or so explaining to him or her what the hell it was that the speaker said. And get it right. Anyway. So amazingly, the bottom line is that we can stay sober through all this confusion. That's the amazing part. I don't know anything about miracles. I'm sure that there are miracles in this room. I don't know anything about success stories. I'm sure that there are success stories in every gathering of people. If I'm a miracle, my sponsor says I can't afford that thought, therefore don't dwell on it. I'm certainly not a success story. But I am an example, good or bad, that Alcoholics Anonymous works on one day of time, a moment at a time, at a heartbeat at a time. I'm an example that Alcoholics Anonymous does exactly what it says it does, provided you're willing to do exactly what Alcoholics Anonymous expects and requests of you. I'm a product of strong sponsorship. Strong, strong sponsorship. I was told very early on that I needed to get a sponsor so an idiot wouldn't be running my life. And I've stayed here long enough under that umbrella to wonder if maybe even when my sponsor's talking, be an idiot running my life. And that qualifies you to be here at least for a few milestones. You have a few milestones of 5 years and 10 years and 15 years and 20 years and 25 and so on, so that you can question some of the authorities around here who really don't know anything either. I've been here long enough in Alcoholics Anonymous, sober long enough to go through changes and wonder what they're about, and I've been here long enough to go through changes to experience them, and now they're my experiences. If you're new or relatively new, what we talk about in here is a lot of stuff, and you don't understand that stuff, and hopefully if you stay here long enough, even if you don't want what I got, you'll stay here long enough to want what you got. You'll stay here long enough that the stuff will someday become your experience. You'll stay here long enough to know that what you're doing really works in your own way of working, in your own way of living. And that's Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're wondering what Alcoholics Anonymous is, don't look for something that ain't here. Don't look for something that's not here. This is Alcoholics Anonymous. Very simple. Simple. Very simple. One alcoholic talking to another alcoholic in such a way that you can understand that it gets through that desperation, through that whole idea of there's no hope, into some kind of a little pilot light inside that turns it up one little turn at a time, or maybe two steps forward and one backward, to the point that just little by little, you build up a little enthusiasm. And I love the enthusiasm of life. I love the enthusiasm of sobriety. Very enthusiastic. Sometimes I cover up the insanity of my life with what seems to be enthusiasm, but I'm told that enthusiasm is God within. And that's about the only thing that I've come to understand about life, is I'm enthusiastic about life. I enjoy life. I enjoy my sobriety. That is not to say that I don't have pain, but the difference is today that I don't live in pain. I get to have some, just like I get to have some of the other emotions that are human, and I've come to understand that. That's what makes me. That's the sum total of the character of my being. I didn't know all those things whenever I was born. I didn't even know if I was an alcoholic when I was born. And I don't really even care if I was an alcoholic when I was born. I know when I took my first drink, somewhere between my first drink and the bottom of that bottle, an alcoholic was born. You can bet on that. Because from the first time I took a drink, something happened. And the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous tells me that that's exactly what's supposed to happen. When an alcoholic takes a drink, something happens. There is an effect, and that effect is that after some amount of consumption, and thank God it doesn't say how much, so after some amount of consumption, you can't distinguish the difference between true or false, right or wrong. That's also the definition of a sociopath and a psychopath and a few other paths, but it's exactly why I drank. I drank for that effect, and I'm not going to stand here and tell you that I had all these feelings of fear and you know, inadequacy and you know, wondering what the real people did, and then I took a drink and I rushed right out in the fast lane of life and said, I found the magic and run on down. I was always in the fast lane of life from the get-go. If you stop and think about it, there's people who watch things happen, there's people who wait for things to happen, there's people who make things happen. And I'm one of those who make things happen. I've always been one of those who makes things happen. For a number of years, what I made happen was a lot of crap. But I never missed a lick, baby. I made it happen. And what I love about life today is I still live an exciting life. It's not boring. And I'm one of those who make things happen. And I've always been that way, and I've come to accept that, and I don't try to change it. It's just that it's a little bit simpler today. What I've come to understand is that what I do today doesn't drive everybody around me near as crazy as it used to. That was my problem. I hear people say, I always felt different. And I'm sure those feelings and emotions are the same. I don't try to say that it's different. But my frustration was, if I could just get all of you in step, I'd be all right. They say that's tied into the ego. I've never really understood that. But I started out in life. I grew up in an alcoholic home. I grew up in an alcoholic family. I don't know if that's a prerequisite anymore than some other thing. It's just where I grew up. It's just the way I grew up. I'm not going to fight it. I never, I listened to, they had a big thing down in Los Angeles area recently about you know, letting the child inside of us come out. Some of us have been, you know, grew up in small and, you know, sick environment, and there's some little child in us that needs to be let out. I never had a problem. The child's never been locked in. It's always been out. I've always acted like a child. I never had a problem with that. People were always telling me that. Say, you act like a child. Kind of like that, tell you the truth. And I've always liked the 10-minute speaker, other people. I've always been selfish, self-centered, and I have never had a problem telling you that. I want you to know that. I had a rule of business, a rule of thumb. If we're going to be in business together, if we're going to do anything together, understand, I'm going to treat you as fair as I know how, which means if you leave anything on the table, it's mine. So it's always going to be exciting because you're going to have to defend whatever it is that you put into the deal. I've always understood that about love. The only thing I understood about love is that if you said you loved me, it just meant I was next. That's the first thing you lay on the table. Now, what are we going to bargain for? It's just, those were the values that I had. A lot of the values that I had, I'm not going to, you know, try to explain or verify the fact that they were something that I grew up in and the environment had a big influence on that. I listened to what I heard. I took what I wanted and left the rest. And I used it any way I wanted to use it. And therefore, the values of life were probably distorted from the very beginning. And one of the reasons they were distorted was because I was selfish, self-centered, self-seeking, a little bit neurotic, and just did what I wanted to do. I've always lived under the code of do the next indicated thing. Really, it wasn't a whole lot different than the way I live today. We say, come in here and live it one day at a time. I used to live like there's no tomorrow. There really isn't a whole lot of difference. I remember where I grew up, the people said if you do certain things, like smoke pot, down in Texas where I grew up, man, if you had a roach in your ashtray, you did 25 years. God, I liked the excitement of that. A lot more than smoking the joint. Because I didn't worry about that. I wasn't going to live another 25 years. It really didn't make any difference. Not a problem. But I liked the thrill of the excitement. I think growing up in that kind of a, you know, background in an alcoholic environment has given me some of the, probably the greatest assets of life that I have today. Particularly here, I grew up with people who were selfish, self-centered, and self-seeking, and very neurotic. And I survived. I got out of there. I lived through it. And isn't that amazing? I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, I sit down in a room with people who are selfish, self-centered, self-seeking, neurotic, and they say, I'm home. I mean, if you can make it here, you got to have some training out there. And I brought all those values here with me, just little by little. They've changed. They've changed simply because that's the part of the program that is really appealing. I'm glad I didn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous and say, this is it. I thought for a period of time this was it, but this ain't it. There's always going to be tomorrow, and tomorrow's going to bring something new. And I always learn something new about me if I stay here today and complete today. And then I have all that information, and I apply it to whatever is given to me tomorrow, and I have the values to use it by. You've taught me that here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know that when I was out there running around. By the time I was 12 or 13 years old, I didn't have any values, really. I had certain things that people said I should have. I should care. I should, you know, be compassionate. I should show certain signs of guilt and remorse. I didn't know what those things were. I really didn't care, to tell you the truth. And at a very early age, I got in a lot of trouble. I've always had a knack for trouble. I don't know if that's negative attention. Some kids throw temper tantrums. I just did various things. I'm a thief. I like to steal. I looked and saw that money buys things, and I didn't have no money, so I took money. You need money if you're going to buy things. Either that or you got to go where the things are and you steal them, one or the other. And I learned that at a very, very early age. I found that there was people who were standing around waiting for something to do, so I asked them if they wanted to go with me. And then when they went with me, I said, see that billfold over there? Steal that billfold. Well, I didn't say steal. I said, give me that billfold. And they gave it to me. I took the money. I bought things. I gave them a reward, and they were happy. And then when I got caught, I said, he stole it. I didn't. That has a very astounding effect on your friend. But what's a friend for if you can't use them? You know, if you keep it exciting enough, I remember I used to go with guys and we'd do this and that. And I'd say, okay, you go get this and you go get that and you go do this and you go do that and bring it back here and we'll have a party. And they'd say, what are you going to do? I said, hell, I got to organize all of you, man. We couldn't even have a party if we didn't have somebody that organized you. I didn't have nothing. Didn't need nothing. They were all going to bring it there, you know. And the problem was is that, you know, I kept having to, you know, it's kind of lonely when you go like hell and then you look back and everybody's gone because you stepped to the right or left. Why, it's lonely out there. So you have to go find another bunch of people and start all over again, organize a new deal. And I was doing that by the time I was 12, 13 years old. I found myself locked up. They wanted to talk to me about my behavior patterns. I seemed to have behavior patterns that were not conducive to the Southern Baptist teachings where I grew up. I know I didn't want any of that crap, man. I went over there, and I mean, as a friend of mine states it, you know, I grew up where there's either Southern Baptists or heathens, and the only way you can tell the difference is the heathens are smiling. They said, if you think that, you're going to hell, and I volunteered. Somebody's got to go, for Christ's sake. I sure as heck didn't want what these other people have, and it didn't look like fun to me. It seemed to be riddled with guilt. And eventually, well, you know, you end up, and they lock you up, and they talk to you about what you're doing, and they try to rehabilitate you. I suppose that's what they're doing. You know, I think Hitler or somebody said, give me their minds till they're 12, and they'll always be Nazis. I don't know who controlled me, but it sure wasn't a Southern Baptist. Because by the time I was 12 years old, I was locked up, and I found out a lot of new things whenever I was locked up from people who had been locked up previously. They teach you those things, and that was much more interesting. And after a period of being locked up and being rehabilitated, they let me out, and I went right back out, and I got back into more trouble because I like trouble, I like the excitement, I like all the thing, and you know, you just go through that one way. It's like. I think in early years, I look back on, you know, there was always some kind of drugs or alcohol involved in my life. I had an uncle who was a doctor. He kept my aunt loaded for 50 years on phenobarbital. She just wandered around and bumped into the walls, you know. Everybody knew why she was that way. They liked her much better that way. But tell you the truth, nobody had a problem with that. Nobody ever called my uncle a dope pusher, you know. They said, just keep Aunt Nina okay, all right, you know. And she just wandered around, you know. But he also had certain solutions for everything else. And I was a hyperactive kid, so they gave me amphetamines to keep me from being hyperactive. That don't even make sense to me today, man. You don't give a speed freak amphetamines to calm him down. I just never figured that out. Now, maybe I was hyperactive because what he'd given me previously hadn't worn off, but they gave me amphetamines. And it just cranked it up another volume. That's all it did, you know. And it just was a blur, hither, thither, and yon. I learned on an early age. By the time, you know, I was 12 years old, I remember I asked one Christmas if they, you know, my heroes were Lash LaRue and Whip Wilson. And I wanted a black hat, black shirt, black pants, you know, black boots, and they gave me a little red wagon. I didn't ask for nothing anymore. I had another reference point. When I was 6, I asked them for a little red wagon, and they took my tonsils out and circumcised me. So I didn't ask. What the hell was that? I mean, after a while, you learn to quit asking, for Christ's sake, you know? Never mind, I'll just get it myself. I just, you know, it's like going to jail once. There's a little fear behind it, but if you've gone one or two or three times, then you know the system, you know the deal, so you just go in and do the deal. And my father was a lawyer, guilt-ridden lawyer, drunk, and I've never resented the fact that he was a lawyer, to tell you the truth. I've always needed one, really. And I had him on retainer for years. Jeez. And he finally drank himself into a position where he became my crime partner. I thought, Christ, you're my lawyer. You're not supposed to be in this deal with me. You know, what the hell? I just pursued that career of not, I'm not going to say I pursued the career of crime. I pursued the life of an alcoholic. You know, I just pursued the life of an alcoholic. I just did the things that I wanted to do things, and I start out to do them, and then I'd find myself in some kind of a problem situation. And I learned to explain that. I learned very early age to not show much guilt. And I don't even know if I had much guilt. Really, never really could look back and see where I had a tremendous amount of guilt. I can definitely tell you that today I have guilt. I understand that, and I understand looking back on it that I'd much rather be an alcoholic who has guilt than a psychopath who don't. There was time whenever I had that down pretty pat, too. And I had guilt. It was just as I got caught. And then it was very short-lived because you have immediately think what in the hell it is that you got to do to get out of trouble, you know? And what that does, it sets up a tremendous rationalizing system. I rationalized and justified things so quickly that it seemed like an intuitive thought. And by the time I was 18, 19 years old, it's bam. I mean, I never thought this is a message for God. I just thought, do it. And I did those little inventories. We all do those little inventories throughout our life. We do it whether we're, you know, the morning after, or whether we're sitting in a jail cell or a divorce court or some kind of a situation, sitting over at the church, trying to, everybody praying on you and praying over you, trying to help you out. I don't know. I do those little inventories and look back on my life, and you know, I'd say, well, I don't think I'm going to do that. I'm going to do this different. You know, chapter 3 talks about that. Chapter 3 is in there for the in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous for people like us who's going to try this and try that and try this and try that. I tried it all. That's what made life exciting, for Christ's sake. I mean, if you just had to go boring down the bar ditch the rest of your life, it's not exciting. I'm going to try this. And I, by the time I was 18 and a half years old, I'd been locked up for a period of time. It let me out. I got on a train down in South Texas, and I'm going back up in the Texas Panhandle to regroup. I usually went home to regroup. That's a good place to go. That's where the money is. That's where the rent-free is. That's where your real friends are. That's where the people who really love you and understand you. And you got to heal up. And so I was going home, and I did one of those little inventories. I got myself some bootleg whiskey down there, some of that corn liquor to do that little inventory. They gave me some money, took me over to the train station. I made a phone call to some friends of mine to meet me in Amarillo, Texas, and I got me a jug of whiskey, and I crawled in this train, and I did one of those little inventories. I rode that train half a day up there in a panhandle, and I look back on my life, and I'm 18 and a half years old. I've been around, up and down. I've been married and divorced more times than I really wanted to talk about. By the time I was 18 and a half years old, I've been locked up for a third of my life. I'd made a lot of money because one of my wives' father had a lot of money. I'm not going to tell you that I earned it, but I earned it. and that had all been taken away from me. I'd had an opportunity to get into the armed services, and I screwed that up because I don't like authority. And what the hell? And all that stuff. I'm looking back on my life, and I couldn't tell you that alcohol or drugs had anything to do with it. You've heard it many times. You'll hear it tomorrow. Victim of bad breaks and rotten circumstances. That's all it was. I looked at all these people. Whenever you're drinking, thinking whiskey, you can always rationalize. You're going to do one of them inventories, so you blame other people. Have something to drink. It clears your vision. I'm going to stay away with guys that carry guns. I'm going to stay away from guys that are always in fights. I'm going to stay away with people who are always stirring crap. I'm going to stay away from sick women. And that's one of the things, man. You line 10 women against that wall over there, and I'll get the sickest one every time. I mean, just boom. And I did that little inventory, and I looked at my life, and I said, man, there's just certain things that I got to stay away from. Now, when I got out of that car and got on the train, I made one phone call. I called Oily and Goose. Oily and Goose were a couple of friends of mine up in the panhandle there that was going to pick me up in Amarillo. And I told Oily and Goose, I'll be coming in, man. I'll be thirsty. And I got on that train, and here I'm looking. I said, got to stay away from people carrying guns. Oily and Goose got a pickup truck with at least two rifles and a shotgun hanging in the back window. And they're going to have 3-2 beer and white lightning. And Oily and Goose, they call them Oily and Goose because they're oily and goosey. And they carry knives and guns, and that's, I'm thinking, I got to stay away from these people. I mean, they're the kind of people, you know, I mean, your friends. They're the kind of people who say, you get in jail, we'll get you out, and if we can't get you out, hell, we'll get in there with you, you know? And drinking that thing in whiskey, I'm thinking to myself, you know, stay away from people like that, stay away from these sick women and all that stuff. And I crawled out of that train, and there's Oily and Goose standing there. And I said, man, it's good to see you. And I put my arm around them, and they give me the old, you know, hug, man. All right, here we go. We got in that pickup truck. It's about a 2.5-hour drive out there where we lived. It's Saturday, and they drug out that 3-2 beer and some white lining. It's in a fruit jar, and I mean, it had things floating in it. And I'm telling you, I got to stay away from people that caused me a lot of trouble. They told me down there when they was rehabilitating me to stay away from people that are in trouble all the time. And Oily and Goose said, you should stay away from people that get in trouble all the time. And right, and I'm going to stay away from these crazy women. These women is women always cause me problems. You know, I try to do my best and give everything to them, and they always, you know, they always treat me wrong, you know. And they said, right, now, both of them guys are getting a divorce, and they, you know, I mean, that's what you need if you're going to talk about sick women and somebody that's just gone through a painful situation with one. And we rode out there and drank that 3-2 beer and white lining, and by the time we got there, I don't know, it was late in the evening, and we pulled up in front of this dance, and we went in the dance, and everybody was standing around. The band quit playing, and I don't like boring, so I grabbed a Coke bottle, rolled it down to the end of the dance floor, and said, let the meanest sucker in the house bring it back, and it looked like a stampede coming my direction. And I may be sick, but I'm not stupid. I ain't going to stay around for a brawl like that. You get whipped. And so I punched the first guy, and I took off. And I'd seen the woman's restroom by the door, and I went running for the woman's restroom in the middle of the confusion. And there was a lady standing there, and I said, tell me when the fight's over. And I ran in and went to the stall, locked the door, and waited. And pretty soon she stuck her head in and said, you come out now. And I went out, and she's standing there, and the band was playing, and the fight was over, and I asked her to dance. What the hell? She's handy. And I mean, that was it. And, you know, I'm a quick study. I found out one quick dance that she had a job, a car, a driver's license, and a place to stay. You know, I didn't have any of those things. And I fell in love with her immediately, you know. I said, you know, I haven't seen you around. She said, I haven't seen you around. I said, well, I haven't seen anybody. I've been locked up for 18 months. And she said, well, I've been in an unwed mother's home. I said, great. Hell, we deserve each other, you know. No problem with that. And, you know, she took me home with her, and we set up a little light housekeeping, and I, you know, I just hung around, you know, and I was about to get in trouble, and you know, I remember, you know, looking back at all that stuff that I said to myself riding up there on that train, that I'm not going to hang around these people, I'm not going to get involved in these, well, I'm just, boom, there I am. I'm right in it one more time. Only worse. Worse. And I don't even know, I couldn't even tell you how I got there. It just seemed like, here I am, I'm not going to do this, and then here I am, and I'm in it. Probably because everywhere I went, I took me, and I'm the first one to get there. And when I got there, there I am. And I like that kind of stuff, and there I am. And I got this woman, there was a few things different, because it never gets better, it always gets worse. She was pregnant. And she said I was her father, and I don't remember that. The book says we cross over an invisible line. I remember I was loaded when we made the trip, you know. And, you know, but I thought, well, I'll try to do the right thing, whatever that is. And I told her to push the car around the block. If you don't miscarry, I'll marry you. She was healthy. And I ended up getting married, and she was pregnant. And, you know, I mean, I role model things all my life. And I went over, and I got a place to stay. And, you know, I you know, tried to gather up the right things. My friends helped me. We tried to set up a house so that we had something that represented a home. I don't know whether I was trying to look like the people across the street. I mean, I just faking it till you can make it, really. I didn't really know what I was doing there. I didn't change a lot of the things. I didn't quit lying, cheating, and stealing just because I was married and had a kid. I just, you know, had to get a place for them because, you know, if you got a wife and a kid, it takes too long for them to pack, so they can't go, you know. And, I just go do my thing, and I get in trouble. And, you know, people tried to help me out periodically. They would try to help my family, tried to help me get an education. You know, people gave me job opportunities. And you know, I tried to do those kind of things. The problem is that when I drink, I really have no thought about working or studying or doing anything like that. Once I start drinking, the ball starts rolling, and I'm not through until we're through. I remember a guy one time held up a fifth of whiskey, and it only had about that much in it. And the guy next to me says, that ain't enough. And I said, oh, ye of little faith, give me that thing. Because where there's one drink, there's another one. And if you give me that much, that'll give me enough courage to find the next one, wherever that is. And I just went, you know, that's the way I drank. That's what I did. I mean, go where you go and do whatever you do. And I kept getting in more trouble. And I found out that, you know, I've got this wife, and she's just getting crazier and crazier and crazier because it's a family disease. It's a family illness. And as we drag them through, you know, all this crap and the insanity of life, why, they get crazier along with you. And, you know, I spared them no expense. I can assure you of that. And, we set up the life of an alcoholic and of an alcoholic family, and we just drug ourselves through the insanity of that. Eventually, I had to leave Texas because if you stay there and do the things I was doing long enough, you'll eventually have to leave. People in Alcoholics Anonymous talk about those trips as geographics. When I left Texas, they call it an unlawful flight to avoid prosecution. I had to get the hell out of Texas. And I loaded up what I had, and I took off. And I came to California. Seemed like the place to go. You know, I mean, I all that things alcoholics of my type certainly has to set up the scenario. You know, I have to get everybody ready, and then I get in trouble, and then we move. Boom, that pushes it over the edge. I always did that. I'd set up the little deal, and then I'd do something that lit the fuse, and away we'd go. And most of the people that were going along thought, it's going to be different over here. And when we got over there, an amazing thing was, there I am. I came to California, thousands of miles from where I was. It took 30 days to make the trip. Most people could do it in 3. Right there ought to tell you something. But the thing of it was, the people that came with me were tired when we got here. And that's good, because I don't have time to mess with them, and they're tired. So I set up a little camp. I found a house. A drunken uncle helped me find his house. It was right in the neighborhood. Perfect, man. There was a motorcycle gang lived on one side of me. There was a bunch of hippies lived on the other side of me. Now, I hadn't seen nothing like that down in Texas. They were all over there taking LSD, taking their clothes off, laying in the front yard, watching the sun come up and go down. And that was kind of interesting. Problem was, they'd go blind, you know, and wander around aimlessly. But I set up this crazy woman and this kid and a dog and a cat and the things that we'd accumulated in this neighborhood, and I took off. And I started running around doing the things that I wanted to do. And now I had a new neighborhood. Now I had a new, you know, place to run. The difference was, they have different codes of ethics and they have different laws. And I started getting in more and more trouble. And eventually I found myself standing in front of a judge one more time, and he's talking to me about me, and he's got the right guy. The problem is, I don't remember nothing he's talking about, but what the hell. I identified with that. I knew one thing, he had the right guy, because I didn't have any of the answers that he was talking about, and he knew more about where I'd been than I knew. So I stood there, and through a series of events, and because of some people, and I suppose a loving God, they talked to me about Alcoholics Anonymous. They gave me an option to go to Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew something about going to jail, and I didn't really want to go to jail. I had some fear of that, matter of fact. I didn't have any fear of Alcoholics Anonymous because I didn't know anything about it. And if you don't know something about something, well, then you really got nothing to fear. So I just, you know, said, okay, I'll try it. And my parole officer and the judge and lawyer and people got together and said I should try Alcoholics Anonymous. And they gave me a number to call, and I called. And a little gray-headed man came over to my house and talked to me about Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, sure, fine, no problem. You know, what's the deal? I said, there's a meeting over here at the church. There's a church around the corner, 2 blocks over here, and you go over there, and they see the big AA sign sitting in front of the church. You go over there, and you go into the meeting. Starts at 8:30, and it's over at 10. Simple, no problem. On Monday night's all I got to do. And I laid down on the couch, and my wife had gone to see her lawyer, and he told her I should go to Alcoholics Anonymous. She didn't know this other stuff was going on. As a matter of fact, she thought I was going away for 3 to 5, and when she came home and saw me laying there on the couch, and she said, her lawyer said that I should go to Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, your lawyer's smart. I should go to Alcoholics Anonymous. I think it's the smartest thing your lawyer's ever said. I mean, I didn't want to tell her. My lawyer said I should go to Alcoholics Anonymous. Let her think it was her lawyer. I mean, the dumb shit. That's the best I could do. I laid there, you know, and how we are. I thought, well, maybe I don't want to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And closer it came to 8:30, I didn't really want to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. About 8 o'clock, she came over, and she'd been carrying this butcher knife around for some period of time. I don't know why. I like guns myself. Up to including that time, we'd been married for over 10 years, and I slept with a loaded 45 with a safety off hammer back shell in the chamber. On the nightstand, she slept with a 12-inch butcher knife underneath the pillow. That's true love. I'm going to tell you something. If you're new and you wonder about God, that's evidence that there is one. Because we didn't sleep with those weapons around us to protect us from them. We slept with those weapons to protect us from each other. She stuck that knife in my face and told me to get up. And I said, where are we going? She said, you're going to that AA meeting. And since they'd taken my guns away and I couldn't defend myself, I agreed to go. I mean, I had a reference point for that. I passed out on her one time 15 minutes into a 2-hour conversation, and she stabbed me all over my back because I wasn't paying attention to her. And when I came to, she poured rubbing alcohol all over and said I had acne in the back. And that'll get you right with Jesus, I'll guarantee you. It'll damn sure make you respect a woman with a knife. And I got up and got in the car. We had an old beat-up Pinto that went down the road crooked. Really living high on the hog. And she drove over in front of this church and had a big AA sign out in front. I'm thinking, man, if the guys in the neighborhood see me over here, they're going to know I've sunk to the bottom for sure. But she stuck that knife in my face and told me to get out. She said she's going to wait right out in front of the door, and she'd case the joint, and that's the only way in and the only way out. And if I came out of that door before 10 o'clock, she was going to gut me. What the hell? I had nothing better to do. And you can keep a guy like me in a room like this. You got a crazy woman circling the perimeter, I'll guarantee you. You don't need much training for that. And I said in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, it was 18, 19 years ago, and I said in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I needed Alcoholics Anonymous more that day than I had in the rest of my life, and not near as much as I was eventually going to need it, but I needed it that day. I was an alcoholic sitting in there. I was an alcoholic sitting in that room. I had a bandage that looked like a turban around my head where I had an altercation with a guy with a 24-inch crescent wrench that tore my ear off. They sewed my ear back on. And I sat in that meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I looked around that room, and I thought, man, I wouldn't even drink with these people. And they went around and said their first name, and I said my first and last name, and I knew that was wrong, you know. And I didn't say anything, and I knew one thing. They talked about getting a sponsor. They talked about working the steps. They talked about going to a lot of meetings, and I had no intentions of doing that. I had no idea what the hell it was. I didn't understand what they were talking about. They talked about all the things that we hear on a regular basis, but I wasn't an alcoholic. And if you're not an alcoholic, you just ain't an alcoholic. It don't make a difference who says or does or whatever. If you're not an alcoholic, you're not an alcoholic. And I know today what it's like to be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous when you're not an alcoholic. Really, really, really. And I've come to understand there's some things that I've understood as a result of going to Alcoholics Anonymous when I'm not an alcoholic. There's basically two kinds of people come to Alcoholics Anonymous. There's people who come to Alcoholics Anonymous to change the conditions in their life, and there's people who come to Alcoholics Anonymous to change their life. And if you come to Alcoholics Anonymous and your sole purpose is to change the conditions in your life, I guarantee they'll change. But you're probably not going to stay. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous to change the conditions in my life. If you come to change your life, there's a possibility. There's a possibility you'll get a hold of this deal. But I didn't come to change the me, I came to change you. And I sat in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I did not drink or use any kind of narcotics. I did that for 4 months, the most miserable time of my entire life, bar none. Absolutely insane. Drives a fire hazard, man, just unbelievable. And that woman made me go, and I went, and I showed them. I didn't rationalize or explain anything. I just knew that this wasn't for me, and I wasn't going to stay, and I was only going to be here long enough to get the heat off. I had in the back of my mind, I knew that there was, you know, problems in my area. Matter of fact, I went next door to where them hippies were, and you know, I've always been able to reach out and get a hold of somebody who knew. You should know the answer. And if you don't know the answer, you should know somebody who knows the answer. And just like when I come off that train down there in Texas, Ole and Goose is waiting on me. Well, whenever I started Alcoholics Anonymous, I went next door, and there was a guy over there by the name of Doc and another guy by the name of Professor. And they were over there in that house next door doing some very interesting drugs. And I went over there and talked to them about me going to Alcoholics Anonymous, and they told me that I'm part Indian. I should not drink that fire water. It drives you crazy. What I should do is take some, you know, some real thinking process things in my life, like tie sticks. Because you mellow out when you smoke tie sticks. You know. I go, really? What do? Really, really? They say, well, we hang around the park and wait for the ice cream truck to come by. I don't know. You know. I never really wanted to do that. Man, I always wanted to rob the ice cream truck. They convinced me, I'll guarantee you. And amazing thing, after 4 months, I did one of them little inventories again. And I looked around, and my old dog's laying next to me, patting him on the head. The cat's in my lap, purring. The kid's over here, pat the kid on the head. She's in the kitchen. I'm back in the big bedroom. I got, you know, the tie sticks are right next door. And, you know, I resigned from Alcoholics Anonymous. An amazing thing happened to me. I got stuck drunk. And I remember when I resigned from Alcoholics Anonymous, I just had that thought to trust. An amazing thing was happening. By going to those meetings once a week for 4 months, people trusted me. It was not a problem for me to disconnect from Alcoholics Anonymous. There was nobody to disconnect from except that woman. And I was sober, and she didn't understand why, and she didn't understand the circumstances because she'd done nothing. She hadn't gone to Al-Anon or anything. She took me over to that church. I got out. I went in. I sat there for an hour, hour and a half. I came back out, and I didn't drink. An amazing thing. And I said, I don't have a problem. And she agreed with that. And I resigned from Alcoholics Anonymous. Boom! The amazing thing was I got struck drunk almost immediately. just almost immediately in the next 3.5, 4 years of my life was absolutely living, screaming hell, because there's nothing worse than being out there with a belly full of booze or arm full of dope and a head full of AA. It just drives you crazy. And all the character defects and the things in my life manifested themselves tenfold, because that's exactly what happens if you're an alcoholic. And I suffered from untreated alcoholism to the max. I'm a physically violent type of person. The anger comes out. The fear comes out. Some people, you know, fear demobilizes them, and they go into the corner and sit down and hunker down like an old mule, and I don't act that way. Fear comes out in anger in me, and it mobilizes me, and I think it's described in the book, we roar through the lives of others like a tornado, and that's the way I was. And I had certain values as you slide down the wall of life, screeching and screaming and squawking while you have to come back with certain actions, and being the very best father I could be, I can remember, I can tell you what it's like one afternoon, 2 o'clock in the afternoon, I'm on my hands and knees in my daughter's bedroom, and I'm just busted her piggy bank, and I'm separating the pennies, nickels, dimes, and quarters, because a big spender like me ain't going to take no pennies down to the liquor store or the Connections house. I got to have all silver. And I had that little feeling, you know, that somebody's watching you, and I turned around, that little girl was hiding in her closet. She's like in there like a wounded animal. And she hadn't even gone to school that day because she was afraid to come out of the house. She didn't even sleep in her bed anymore because she was afraid to be someplace where people anticipated where she'd be. So she hid around mostly in that closet. And that day, being the very best father I could be, I give that kid a break. I let her shoot behind me and get out of that room without inflicting some kind of a painful memory on her that far superseded what she saw me in, because that's the way I was. That's the kind of an alcoholic I am. If you catch me in that pitiful, incomprehensible, demoralizing situation, it is absolutely necessary, maybe not immediately, but sooner or later, I've got to inflict some kind of a painful situation in your life that umbrellas and blots out what you saw me in. And you can bet on it. You can just bet on it. And what that does, it creates an umbrella of fear and anxiety and terror. And that's the way we live. That's the way we live, not one day or a week or a month, but we live that way for the next 3.5 to 4 years. And the people around me just got crazier, and I got crazier as the desperation comes. Then we just, you know, we try to, you know, it's an amazing thing. You either attract the things you fear the most, or you attract the things you love the most. You come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and we try to teach you that by these principles, we attract the things we love the most. We say we love you, and we don't even know what that means. But what that is trying to convey a message of the fact that you're safe here, you're comfortable here, we understand. By the same token, the other side of the coin, if you attract the things you fear the most, it's absolutely necessary for you to take people hostage. It's absolutely for you to umbrella over their life all the things that's against the very nature of their being. It's absolutely necessary for you to make them hate you, and it's absolutely necessary for you to kill them if you can't snuff the damn love out any other way. And you either do one or the other. You either do one or the other. And each of us have our own characteristics, a way of doing it, but you either do one or the other. There is no black and white. There's gray when you live like that. And I attracted all the things that I feared the most. I attracted all those things. Anything that meant anything to me, I smothered it to death. Anything that had any, you know, affection coming my way, it was absolutely necessary for me to try to prove that's wrong. Because I'm an alcoholic, and as my disease progressed, I progressively hated myself. And as I progressively hate myself, and you progressively tell me you love me, it's necessary for me to inflict some kind of proof that you can't love me. And that drives people crazy. It's the Al-Anon syndrome that just drives them crazy. They cannot understand why they tell us we love them. And we always, you know, have the guilt and remorse of the next morning, oh, I love you, I love you. Hell, I had no problem getting on my knees in the front yard of my house and begging to get back into my own home. Hell, I could cry with the best of them, man. And that woman had let me in, kid, and the neighbors would get over there and let, no, don't make daddy cry. And they let me back in that house. And within 60 minutes, man, I'm chasing around the house with a gun, screaming, and out the door they go. Now I got the fort, you know. Now they got to beg to get in. It's just insane. We just did that day in and day out, and eventually, you know, I just ran myself out of everything, and I eventually couldn't stand myself, and the people just looked at me and said, you know, we ain't going with you. We're not going with you. I ran out of friends and enemies at the same time. I just... Most of all, I ran out of enablers, for God's sakes. You know, as long as there was somebody that had come along and pat me on a poo-poo, give me another $5, bail me out of the deal, do one more thing, man, I ain't going to do nothing about me. I'm that way today. If anybody will do it for me, hell, I'll let you. You know? The same, I mean, I'll let somebody I sponsor, I'll tell him something new and let him try it to see if it works. If it works, I'll try it. You know? I mean, don't come here and think you change that much. The difference is I'm just not sending that woman in the front door of a bar that I just shot a shotgun into the back door. You run around and go in the front door, and I'm going to blow the back door off the hinges. They come out, I'm going to take everything they got. But she's got to go in the front door, for Christ's sake. And, you know, they just said, no more, man. No mas. That's it. And I had nothing else left to do but to drink. And I went off by myself, and I started drinking. And I drank as long as I could, as hard as I could. And the amazing thing about this disease is what used to give me some kind of relief, it no longer gave me relief. If I could buy a second, if I could buy a heartbeat right now, if I could buy one tenth of a moment, somebody else would be standing here. I mean, I plugged it in. One more quarter. Play another song, Sam. Do it one. Just, you know, shoot it, pop it, stick it in, whatever, man. And it ain't working. It ain't working. You can pass out. You can come too. But you know beyond a shadow of a doubt that shit stinks and you're in it. And it don't make any difference whether you create more crap. It's just more crap. And you don't have the answer to this. You don't have the answer to that. And whatever you put in here, whatever combination. You know, I went to a safety meeting where I worked the other day, and they had some narc that works for, you know, industrial narc. They're the worst kind. He's making a living. What the hell? But he tried to explain my bottom. He tried to tell me what you're like when you experience cocaine. He tried to explain what you're like when you experience alcohol. He tried to explain what you're like, your behavior patterns, and what you think like when you use heroin. And I'm sitting there thinking, you don't know shit. First of all, I was never pure when I did anything. And he was explaining it like as if you're pure. You know, I never had just heroin. Who wants that? You've got to have a little peppermint schnapps. You know? You've got to have something on your stomach to keep you from throwing up all the time. You had to, when you did speed, you had to cycle right. You had to have something in there that kept you even. You know? If you're going to be a bullet, you don't want to drop. That's a depression. You know, and I'm listening to the guy and what he's talking, he don't know. I mean, he's a non-alcoholic trying to explain what you, if it was a test tube. Sure, if you was a test tube and that's all you had, that's right. But the important thing that I was trying to do was be absolutely certain that I was unpredictable. And that's frustrating because you cycle in and you cycle out. And you cycle in and you cycle out. And the frustrating part about that is that you can't make it stop anymore. You can't stop here. And you ain't going nowhere. You're not going where. I mean, I know what power is. You take a double-barrel shotgun. I robbed a poker game one time, and I took a double-barrel. Three of us went into a poker game. I took a double-barrel sawed-off shotgun, had hammers on it, and three-inch mag. And I went in there, and those guys, it was a big poker game, and these guys stuck in there scraping the money, and I knew they were getting the money because I told them, you get the money. And I stuck a double-barrel shotgun under a guy's chin, and I raised him up on his toes, and I took his billfold out of his back pocket, and I pulled the hammers back one by one, and he peed himself. God, I love that. Jesus! That's power! But that was my values. I could have you laying on the floor and stick a gun in the back of your neck, and I'm taking your billfold, and I think I got you. I ain't got you. You got me. For the rest of my life, I'm running from you. If I kill you, I'm running for them. If I don't kill you, I'm running from you and them. And that's what I was experiencing in my bottom. When it don't work no more, all those things are there, man. They're looking at me. And I see them. And you can't hide from them. Nothing turns it off. When you come to, there it is. All those black eyes. Me taking that kid to the hospital, the old lady's in the car, and I'm screaming at both of them. I don't give a damn if your shoulder's out of socket. When we get to the hospital, don't tell them I did it. Tell them you fell off the damn porch. There it is. And no matter what I drink, no matter what I put in it, there it is. One more time. And I can't stand that no longer. And when you can't stand it any longer, there's only one place to go. Here. That's why if you get pissed off at us, be careful how noisy you are when you leave, because you're probably going to have to come back. I mean, that's good information. I've been in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous more out than in for the previous 3.5, 4 years, and I had to come back. I didn't come here because I wanted some of your good coffee. I wanted your camaraderie, your fellowship. I didn't want no red jelly donuts. I didn't want a loan. I didn't want a woman. I didn't want nothing. Man, I couldn't have got a hooker with $1,000 bill in each hand when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. They ain't had it up in months, man. And you women can fake that deal, but us guys have a little trouble. There wasn't no lover in my area when I got here, I'll guarantee you. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous because it was the last house on the block, man. It's the only place to go. And I came here because I knew that you had something here. I didn't know what it was. I didn't know if I could do it. I didn't know how to do those things. I was willing. And a little gray-headed man made a 12-step call on me, and he said, "Hey, this is it. Man, you don't have to take a drink again as long as you live if you don't want to." And I didn't know how you could do that, but he set the hook. He said, "You don't ever have to be lonely again." And that loneliness was driving me crazy, and I couldn't stand the loneliness. And I believed him, and I followed him, a total and complete stranger. I followed him into Alcoholics Anonymous, and he paved the way for me, and he's a beautiful little guy, and I talk to him at least once a week now, and he's still sober, and he loves me. He's seen me. It's important for me to talk to that guy. He's important for me to talk to that guy because he's seen me when I couldn't see me. And he don't ever let me forget that either. And I'm grateful for that. That's important. You know, he saw me whenever I was sweetly reasonable. He saw me at the point of my insanity. He saw me at the point of whenever I was so desperate that I'd ask a total and complete stranger that simple, simple thing that we absolutely must ask. Help me. Help me. I mean, it just sticks in my throat when I think about it. And yet it's the very thing that opened the doors of my life. And I said, "Help me." And he did, because he believed in Alcoholics Anonymous then and he believes in it today. And he's an example of that very fact. And he took me to you, and he took me a place where people understood. And I didn't come in here, like I say, you know, just put the plug in the jug and do that. You know, people explain that much differently than I do. I came here, and I was just glad to be here, but I brought me. And I sat in meetings, and I'm flying apart. I sat in a meeting, and I just moved my chair around. It just like something, it's like it had wheels on it. And I sit in there, and I'd cycle through all those emotions, and I'd be up, and then I'd be crying. And all those things are just loose. Man, when you take the drugs and alcohol out of it, it takes about 90 days to flush the system. And while that's happening, man, I'm cycling. I'm crazy. I got problems, man. You want to talk to me about problems? I'll tell you about problems. The book says waves of the past roll over. Man, I had some big shit following me when I come in here. People are going to kill me. I owed a lot of money to people. You don't write them a letter and say, "Hey, you know, I'll send you $100 a month. I killed the guy, and I didn't. How are you going to make amends to that? Well, you go to his family and tell him, you know, "Hey, I'm sorry. Hey, man, his two brothers said they're going to blow a hole in my ass sometime in the next 10 years, and I can think about that one day at a time." I didn't know. You're going to hold your hand up in a meeting and say, "Oh, $250,000. Anybody got any money?" You know, I mean, I hold my hand up and say, "I got 5 pounds of coke over here in the safety deposit box. Anybody want to help me go take it to the people that it belongs to?" I mean, I didn't know what the hell to say. I tried to talk to my sponsor about that. They gave me one of them hard-hearted sponsors, the kind of guy that was just, he said, "Don't drink and just keep going to meetings. Do what I tell you. You know, and I'll show you what to do. All this other stuff will take care of itself." And, you know, that's really the truth. That's really what has happened in my life. I went to meetings, I didn't drink, and all this other stuff taking care of itself. I wish I could tell you if you were new exactly how that happened, because it should seem to me like it's logical, but it's not logical. It's spiritual. And there is no explanation for that. I know that people helped me, and some of the things I had to do myself. You know, there's some real important things in these steps here. It says, God will not do for you what you can do for yourself. That means there are some things, even though you may be nuts. You need to do certain things, and I had to give certain things back to people, and I had to do certain things in the early part of my sobriety, and I'm glad that the fear didn't demobilize me. I ended up with this crazy lady, and she started going Al-Anon, and she started releasing my ass right away, I'll guarantee you. I felt that right away. She has never resented the method of my recovery, nor has she ever deprived me of the privilege of making my financial amends all by myself. Just as long as I was able to maintain the manner in which she'd grown accustomed to living. I'm faced with all these things. And I started going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous one day at a time. And I started practicing these principles and all my affairs one day at a time. And I had no idea what the hell it was. And when I was new, I was so crazy. I carried guns around on me all the time. There are certain meetings. There's meetings that I'm very grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous in Southern California because there's all kinds of meetings. I went to men's stag meetings because my native tongue was profanity and there was a lot of crazy people there, and they understood me, and I couldn't intimidate them. I think that's so important for my kind of an alcoholic, that there's people in Alcoholics Anonymous that I cannot intimidate them. They've been where I've been, they've done what I've done, and they understand, and I cannot intimidate them. And I'm grateful for that because they said, you know, you can't run your crap out of here. We're not afraid of it, nor are we afraid of you. And that is the part of Alcoholics Anonymous that makes me feel safe. There's a lot of things that if we did out there on those streets that we get by with in here, we'd probably die. But in here, there's people that understand, and they tolerate us, and they allow us the time to change. And they love me, and I didn't know what love was. They showed me, for a guy like me, love is an action. And an action, the first act of love is the act of transparency. I must let you see in. If I can let you see in, and little by little I can see out. And I believe in working the steps exactly like they're written. But if you're new or relatively new, if you've been around here for some period of time, what I see in those steps and the way I'm able to work them little by little is the best I can do. And I have come to understand that little by little I'm able to work those steps and apply those principles in my life a little different each day, a little better each day, with a little clarity each day, with a little more serenity each day. And when I came here, I did an immoral inventory. I did a fearful inventory because that's all I knew. That's the only thing I knew. I tried to impress people with all my sick crap, my sex inventory and the violence and all that kind of stuff. And they just listened to me. And the most important part of love is the act of patience and listening without even a response. And I've come to understand through sponsorship that that is one of the most important things, is for me to show you, or at least attempt to, you know, fake it, that I'm interested. And people did. That's exactly the way they treated me. They were very harsh and they were very stern with me, but they were interested. They showed some interest. They didn't necessarily have my answers. And when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was riddled with images. I think it's fantastic. You see, people come to Alcoholics Anonymous, we don't know who in the hell we are. We don't even know whether we're walking or riding a bicycle. And we come here and we get our mentors in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I try to be just like my sponsor, just like my hero. And heroes are necessary in Alcoholics Anonymous. People to look up to are necessary. Man, when we come in here, we're so low down in self-worth, we're on the gutter. If you don't have somebody to look up to, man, you can't see nothing. There is no hope. And what you do speaks so loud, I can't hear a word you say. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I tried to be like you. And I'm still trying to do those things. And what that has done, little by little, it's revealed me to me. It's as simple as the ABC. But when, in my experience, it's been a transition, experientially, little by little, by me trying to act like you and the people in Alcoholics Anonymous, even though I felt phony and I got angry at myself for trying to mock somebody else, little by little what happened was I was changing. And I hate change, don't you understand? I'm afraid of change. When you go through life like I did, where you're crazy all the time, it's just cycling all the time, then I don't have to worry about some gradual change of transition where you're serene and predictable and humble and kind and gentle and loving. I don't even like the sound of that today. I just do it a little bit. And what I've come to understand is little by little I told people about me, and I'd tell one guy a little bit about me and another guy a little bit about me, and then I was riding a car one night in a van and they were all in there and they all knew about me. And I tested them, and they just laughed and said, you know, we know everything there is to know about you. We knew that the minute you walked in Alcoholics Anonymous and said you were an alcoholic. We'd either done it or thought about doing it and felt just as guilty for thinking as we did for doing it. I didn't understand what they were talking about, but I knew they were together. And they told me they cared about me. And you know, I'm grateful for those things that looking back on those experiences, I'm grateful that people took me. They took me to a lot of meetings, said I was going to have to be active. And I'm a believer in activity. You know, those are the character assets of my life that are still important to me today. You come to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and sit in here and listen and do the things, and it seems like you're okay, but nobody knows you. You got to take a chance. You got to get off that wall and stand out here and do things like the committee and other committees here have done. And you bet when you step off that wall and step out in that spotlight, people are going to see your character defects, and they're going to say, what happened to the loving Keith we knew before? Well, you just gave me a commitment, and I just ran it up your ass, that's all. And I've done it better than anybody. And, And all of a sudden you're out there one more time and you find out that you got a little more work to do along the way. I've just done those things. I just run out there and I've had sponsorship that says, man, they can't shoot arrows in your ass if you're behind them. And I've done out there. The amazing thing is I looked around and here's some guy beside me, I'm very privileged that I've been able to work with young people in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I love young people in Alcoholics Anonymous. It isn't something that I designed or plotted out or said I was going to do. I just went trucking along, and I was busy, and all of a sudden I look, and there's a guy standing next to me, and he's sobered up when he's 16 years old, and he ain't been where I've been, and he ain't done what I've done. But he can look at it, and he can look at himself, and he can see that he's been in a lot of places that I ain't been. And at 16 years old, and he's hanging on, and he's hanging on with what I'm doing, and he's willing to go, and he has a willingness, and he's not a biased and opinionated with 30 years of lies and deceiving ideas, and all of a sudden he's willing to do these things, and he's breathing a new breath of fresh air in me. I hang around with a lot of young people in Alcoholics Anonymous. I also hang around with my peers. I have an opportunity to be with my peers, the people that know me and saw me, and the people that are sober longer than me. And I try to have a balance in Alcoholics Anonymous in that sense of the activity that I do. And I hang around the old-timers, and I've been taught to respect the old-timer, to respect them. That's a vital, important part of my life, is to respect them the same way I respect Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've been taught to do those things. Those are the values that I've come to understand here. And each person has to come to those same values and come to peace with themselves, I suppose. Like I said, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I couldn't have got a hooker with a $100 bill. I wasn't a womanizer. That's not my cross to bear. I figure if you got money, you can get anything you want. I like money. I like material things. And that's been the thing that, has been one of my greatest character defects in sobriety. But there are other things that have been reference points in my sobriety. I've been with the same lady now for over 30 years, and we've been married almost 29 years, and we've been together 30. And, I had no faith. I had no faithful values, and I had no loyalty to that relationship or whatever. I said I did. I've had the oath. I've done all those things. I belonged to clubs and gangs and groups and all those things. But I had no loyalty. And when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, they told me certain things that I got to do and certain things. I look back on my life and I drank when I didn't do them. And I've been faithful to that lady now for going on 15 years, ever since I've been sober. It ain't because I wanted to be. I'll guarantee you. And I guarantee you there's a few times when I needed to step outside that circle. In my mind, But what I look at as a simple fact is that I never did those kind of things before without drinking, during, before, after. And besides that, it's always been my pattern to step on some sick person's back in order to raise myself out of the gutter. And there are certain values that I refuse to do because I'm not going to water down my sobriety with other people's blood. But I've come to understand little by little when I came here and I started, placing the values on sponsorship, to be loyal to a sponsor, to be loyal to Alcoholics Anonymous, to be loyal to this lady, what that put in all my life in those areas of relationship is trust. That was a value that was never there before. And by the fact of me doing these things one day at a time, and the activity that I've done one day at a time, and trying to be loyal and be honest and true to that relationship, that put trust in that relationship. And I woke up one day and this lady that I've been married to and been with, I've been faithful to her. And what that gave us in that relationship is trust. And when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I trusted no one. And the reason I didn't trust no one is because I ain't trustworthy. It's just that simple. If you don't trust no one, it's because you ain't trustworthy. You expect them to live by the same values you have, and the ones you have are sick. And that's exactly what I brought to Alcoholics Anonymous. And little by little, what I've come to understand by doing my laundry from the inside out, by coming here and doing these inventory and trying to just suit up and show up, I've become trustworthy. And what that means is that there's some values in these relationships. And what that really means, if you want to know what I'm really, really, really talking about, I'm talking about if you get your house in order, you trust your God. That's how you get it. You can't come here and you get the faith, but you can't come here and get the trust if you're cheating over here and cheating over here and scamming over there and scamming over there. It just don't work that way, baby. I'd like to bring you better news, and I'd like for it to be sweeter and smoother, but it ain't. You got to get your house in order. When you're current, you look around. What you look around is you got a quiet heart. May not be all day long. Don't make much difference about that kind of a deal. It's just the fact that when you're current, you know there's something inside of here. And you're loyal to one. You're loyal to yourself. You want to know what self-worth is? It's being loyal to yourself. I don't have to water me down. I don't have to rationalize nothing if I don't want to. I don't have to make no excuses to anybody if I don't want to. I get to stand out there on the street and hold my head up. I don't have that kind of guilt. Sometimes I got the frustration because I don't get my own way, and sometimes I got the inadequacies because I'm only human. But I don't have to if I don't want to, because I know one thing that book said. Beyond a shadow of a doubt, I only have to answer to one. I crawl before no one, man. I stand there and I take my hit. And I answer to one. And you can't answer to that one until you got your house in order. If you don't trust nobody, you can't trust God. And it comes in time. It takes time. The important thing I'm trying to tell you is it's worth it, man. It's worth every stinking deal you got to go through to get it. And I don't look down on nobody. If you got to go out here and drink or use, that's fine. But I'm going to tell you something. You don't have to. It don't take nothing to walk out that door and pick up a drink. It takes guts to stay here. It takes guts to stay here and pull the load and do the things. You know, there's never been nothing in my sobriety that's been conducive to my sobriety that I've wanted to do. I got one thing. It's called a flag up, man. Whenever a sponsor starts to give me direction, it goes like this. I don't have to say it, but automatically the flag goes up. And that don't make any difference, man. You just got to do it. And if you do it, it teaches you a pattern of living that allows you to cleanse that deal and you get a new set of values. You know, when I grew up back in the Texas Panhandle farming community. And I heard a story when I was new in Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to share it with you real quick and I'll shut up. There's a little boy and his daddy was standing out there alongside the road, and they lived in a farming community. And in his farming community, the road that went into town was right there going by their farm, and they had a big barn on the farm, and they standing there probably one Saturday morning, and a dude come whipping down the road in a great big old black Buick, and he whipped in that driveway, and he went over. The little boy watched the whole deal, and this guy talked to the farmer, and money changed hands, and the dude backed that Buick down there by that barn and opened the trunk, and the little boy went down and looked. He wondered what was going on, and this guy gets some paper out, and he starts rolling this stuff on the side of that barn so that it could be seen from that road, and he stood there and he watched this deal. He never seen anything like that in his life. And what was going on inside that barn was a poster of a circus. And he'd never seen it. He'd been around a farm all his life. He'd seen all kinds of animals. And here was something new, man. And he was totally amazed. And what went up there was a poster of this circus coming to town and had the beautiful people and all their beautiful costumes and all the beautiful animals and living color. And he went to his daddy and he said, "Daddy, you know, I see this deal, you know, and what is it?" And he said, "It's a circus, son. And it's coming to town. If you work real hard when it comes a day for the circus, well, I'm going to give you the money and you can go to town and see the circus." And the little boy went down there every day and looked at that deal. Sometimes two or three times a day, he'd just stand there and look at it. In his mind, he fantasized what it was going to be like. And each day he'd look at that deal and he could hardly wait until it come time. And he did extra chores, and come day, whenever the circus was coming to town and the father being a good father and doing exactly what he said he'd do, he'd give the kid a 50-cent piece. And the kid walked 6 miles to town. When he got to town, there it was. In those days, the circus would set up a big top down on one end of town, and they'd come in on a train. When it come the day for the circus to open, they'd put on their costumes and get the animals off the train and they'd make a parade right down through the center of town, and they'd go right down into the big top. And that morning when that little kid walked into town, he looked right there it was, coming right down the center of that town. He'd sit down on the curb. And there they were in living color, man, all the people in their beautiful costumes and the animals. He'd never seen anything like that in his entire life, the greatest show on earth going right before him. And he sat there in complete and total awe. And the last person in that parade was a clown. When that clown went by the little boy, he tipped his hat. And the little boy didn't know what to do, but he flipped the 50-cent piece up into the clown's hat. He caught it, and the little boy got up, and he walked the 5 or 6 miles back home. And when he got home, his dad met him right there at the front door, and he said, "Did you enjoy the circus?" And the little boy, was all he could think about home was just that fantastic experience. And he said, "Oh, man, I loved it." You see, that's a sad story. That's the unfortunate part. It's not a happy story. Because the kid never saw the circus. All he saw was a passing parade. God, I don't want to be a sad story. I was a sad story all my life, man. Ever since I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, May 11, 1976, I've been in the big top. I've been in there, baby, and I want to stay in there. I want it all. I ain't going to sit on the curb and let it pass my ass by. I want to turn those character defects into greed. Give it to me. Let me have it all. I'll take it. I want to be the best member of Alcoholics Anonymous I can be. Man, you can pass right on through here, but I ain't going nowhere. You know, you can have that. You can have that. Don't take much, just every damn thing you got, but it's worth it. I'm glad I got that today because I can be with you and I enjoy being with you. I enjoy life. I enjoy every bit that you've given me, the experience of life. And you can have that. If you don't have that today, I hope to hell you stay here until you enjoy it. Hope you can stay here and get a little piece of this deal. You got to have a couple of reference points of good days and some good experiences, because you got to be able to look back on it. When you're new and you come here, everything's just that parade, man. It just looks like it's going by you and you ain't getting nothing. You stay here and just a little bit at a time, it comes to you. It comes to you. And you get those reference points, those good days, and it gives you something to hold on. That's what this deal is here. We don't come here, man, to give you no baptism or pray over you or nothing. We come here to...